Hey, Bill Nye, the Science Guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Yes, I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Today is March 23rd, 2011. Welcome to the Humanist Hour podcast. I am your host, Todd Stiefel.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. The Humanist Hour is the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. Humanism is the life stance that humans can be good without a belief in God or the supernatural. So we've got a little laundry list of things to talk about before we get to today's guest. But real quickly, let's just tell our listeners that today's guest is Fred Edwards of the United Coalition of Reason, which we heard just a little bit about last month. So before we hear from Fred, Todd, let's talk about some news. What's happening in the movement lately?
All sorts of stuff is going on. A couple cool things for the American Humanist Association. Two significant figures in the organization will have much larger voices in the greater world. Dave Niosi, the president of the AHA, is now an official columnist for Psychology Today. And
that's
awesome. Very cool. I look forward to seeing his articles there. And Roy Speckhart, our executive director, is now a columnist for the Huffington Post.
That's right, listeners. And if you would like to read any of Roy's articles in his column, you can go to huffingtonpost.com/Roy-Speckhart. That's huffingtonpost.com/Roy, R-O-Y, dash, S-P-E-C-K-H-A-R-D-T. So, Todd, it's March. You know what that means?
Leprechauns?
Yes. leprechauns is one thing. I was going more for March Madness in basketball.
Oh, okay. My next guess was the Ides of March and assassinating emperors. But okay, yeah, we could talk March Madness. It's a good time of year for that. Who are you pulling for?
Well, my original team, I like UNC and I like Louisville. So since Louisville is not in it anymore, I am going for UNC.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's all right.
No, not about Louisville.
I know.
Like UNC.
I got it because you're Duke. I understand. You're Duke. I'm UNC. I understand completely. I think it's pretty cool that BYU, Brigham Young University, has a player, an amazing player from my area of New York. He's from Glens Falls, so it's kind of neat to see him representing upstate New York, you know.
I have to say he is an amazing player.
Isn't he?
He's a very legitimate player of the year candidate.
Yeah. I watched him on Saturday when they were playing against Gonzaga, and he just did this pull-up three-point jumper. And
oh, I saw that.
Like he was moving like to the sideline, jumped in the air for a shot, and like squared up midair, and just impresses me. And it was just like it was nothing but net. It was awesome.
Jimmer Fredette is unbelievable, I have to say. That guy's a heck of a player. I wish he was on Duke. It'd be useful.
But he's not.
He is not. What's also interesting is what happened to one of his teammates.
Absolutely. Why don't you tell the listeners about what's going on with Brigham Young and maybe why they're not going to do so well after all.
Yeah, they had a player, Brandon Davies, who was their third leading scorer and their top rebounder. He was a starter on the team and one of their stars, and he was actually suspended from the team for an interesting reason. He was suspended for violating the school's honor code, which usually when you hear about this at a university, it's typically they stole something or
cheated or
academic cheating or something like that. So usually when I first heard this story and I saw it got suspended, I was like, oh my gosh, another cheater. You know, this happens all the time. But no, while my initial reaction was this guy's got to be a scumbag, when I learned more about the story, it turns out the violation of the honor code was that he had sex with his girlfriend, of all things. Premarital sex of any kind is against the honor code, so much so that they suspended this young gentleman and threw him off of the basketball team for the rest of the season, which not only hurts him, but really hurts the rest of his team, hurts their chances of going much further in the tournament this year. I have to say that this is a tough issue because on one hand, you've got an honor code, which people are supposed to follow. And I totally understand that there should be consequences for violating an honor code. But at the same time, this honor code is something that probably should be violated. It's an immoral honor code. If you're,
let's read a little bit of the honor code statement. So this is the Church Educational System Honor Code. As a matter of personal commitment, faculty, administration, staff, and students of Brigham Young University, which is Hawaii or Idaho, and LDS Business College seek to demonstrate in daily living on and off campus those moral virtues encompassed in the gospel of Jesus Christ and will be honest, live a chaste and virtuous life, obey the law and all campus policies, use clean language, respect others, abstain from alcoholic beverages, tobacco, tea, coffee, and substance abuse, participate regularly in church services, observe the dress and grooming standards. I like that grooming is added to that. Encourage others in their commitment to comply with the honor code. Okay. Pretty interesting situation, just the honor code in general. But I guess the players, they signed it, right? They said that they're going to abide by it.
Yes, they did.
And he broke the rule, as ridiculous as an outsider might think that it is. Like, he signed it and he went back on his word.
That's true. So do you think they were just in suspending him?
As a former college athlete, some people sort of hold me in contempt because I was an athlete and because they thought that we got special privileges.
Did you?
I don't think so. I never had, because some professors automatically judge you. They don't like you because you think that you're entitled to things that other students don't, like walking into school late or missing classes because you have a game or getting an extension on assignments and things like that. And on one hand, sometimes you do need that. But on the other hand, sometimes I think students stretch that. And that might be the case, you know, the higher up. You know, I went to a Division III school. So, you know, we weren't like our school's pride. But, you know, BYU, I'm sure, as they're in the now Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament, they probably are part of the school's pride. So I don't know how I feel about it. That was a lot of talk for me to say, I don't know.
it's a tough call. I personally think that it's one of those situations where let's look at the benefits versus the harm. First of all, what are the benefits versus the harm of this particular part of the honor code? Well, it's ridiculous to be suspended from an academic institution, even if it's just from the basketball team, for premarital sex. Yeah, okay, that's their honor code, but I totally disagree with that. I think their morals are fundamentally flawed. But then let's go on a little deeper. So, all right, he did agree to it. He said, this will be my moral code and I'll live by it. Now, on one hand, how much choice did he have in that? How many scholarships did he have offered to him? I mean, it's not easy to get an athletic scholarship in this country. And so it's entirely possible he picked BYU because that was where he could get an education. He couldn't afford to go somewhere else.
Absolutely.
I don't know how heavily recruited he was, but it's possible this was his only good path to having a good career and getting publicity that might eventually lead to an NBA career or a professional career in basketball overseas. Or maybe, like most athletes, maybe this is just a great way for him to get an education so he could have a career like anybody else outside of athletics.
Right.
And he just signed the honor code because he was required to go down this path that's good for him and his future and his family. So in that case, you know, maybe he's signing on to an unjust honor code that's morally flawed out of necessity rather than out of conviction. I believe he is a Mormon, so maybe not.
I wonder if does it have to happen on campus or off campus? And how did the school find out?
I think he got his girlfriend pregnant.
I see.
Yeah, there seems to be some differing opinions about that on the internet, but the rumor is that he impregnated his girlfriend. So
it's a shame that he's not Catholic then, because he could have said Immaculate Conception, man. Wasn't me.
It wasn't me. It was the Holy Spirit, baby.
So listeners, we'd love to hear what you think about this this honor code at Brigham Young University. Please feel free to let us know by calling the Humanist Hour listener comment line, which is 202-618-1371. Again, that's 202-618-1371. We'd love to hear what you think.
Well, in other interesting and productive news for the AHA, we made some progress in Florida. The Lady Lake Town Commission had been opening its meetings with prayer. And as we all know, that's unconstitutional and has been found to be such in many court cases. Well, the AHA reached out to them and they actually were willing to switch. And oftentimes that's not something these commissions will do on their own. Oftentimes they have to be kind of forced along through the legal system, but we were very fortunate here and they did the right thing and they actually changed their prayer to a moment of silence, which is pretty cool. So moving in the right direction. Now we just have to get them to switch it over to a moment of science and we'll be doing real well.
Nice, Todd. It's always nice when government entities will respect and value views that are different than maybe the majority of whoever is a part of that group.
Exactly. The goal here is, in my mind, the government needs to try to be non-divisive and try to treat its citizens equally. And that means not catering to any particular group of them through anything. I think it would be equally inappropriate to open their meetings with a yoga meditation because of its roots in Hinduism. So I think this is a good alternative. At least a moment of silence is something everybody can do their own thing with.
So Todd, this sounds familiar to me. What about you? It's just this need that we have for the government to recognize non-religious values just as much as religious beliefs.
Well, it's critically important. The government shouldn't treat any of its citizens differently than any others. And we are making progress, but there's clearly a long way to go. I mean, for example, we had Justin Griffith from the Rock Beyond Belief event on the show a few months back, and there have been a lot of developments in this story, and unfortunately in this case the government decided to take the wrong route and specifically discriminate against non-theists. It's really a shame what's been happening over there.
Yes, Todd, that's actually what I was thinking, and we actually are fortunate to have with us, or with you in your office, Jason Torpy, who is the president of the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers, and he also serves on our board of directors, so the board for the American Humanist Association.
Yes, welcome, Jason. Jason is a West Point graduate and a heck of a guy. He serves as well as a member of the board of directors of the Secular Coalition for America. Thanks for joining us today, Jason.
So, Jason, we understand that Rock Beyond Belief, which our listeners might recognize from a couple months ago when Justin Griffith was talking about the event that he was planning on a military base to reach out to fellow atheists through rock and roll and through some speakers like Richard Dawkins. We understand that that event has now been canceled. Is there anything that you can think of that our listeners can do to help support what's going on or to help support Justin Griffith and Rock Beyond Belief or MASH?
The main thing is to call up your senators and representatives and let them know that, ask them questions like, what is the military doing for non-theists? What are they doing for our community? Say, I know what they're not doing for our community. They're not providing equal support for Rock Beyond Belief for that particular event. But ask them what materials, what education, what support they're providing, what local events are going on. Ask them how many informational packets about humanism they have in chaplains' offices, how many to reach out to humanists, to be clear, not to reach out to Christians. They have plenty of Christian information. But what do they have to reach out and show that they're going to support humanists? Ask them how many local organizations chaplains know about that they can refer humanists in the military to so that they can find their local community. What are they doing for us? Ask that question. And if they need the answer they can find is through the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers. We have all that available and we're reaching out and we're waiting for them to recognize their responsibilities to us as well.
Thank you, Jason. So you heard it, listeners. Get in touch with your local representatives. Find out how your local branch of the military, combined with your local branch of government, is supporting the free thinkers and atheists in the military in your community. Well, switching gears, Todd here is chomping at the bit to challenge Jason. Todd, why don't you take it here?
So Jason, I saw some interesting articles, one of them written by you and one in response written by Fred Edwards on the topic of omnivorism versus veganism and whether or not it is humanist to eat meat. And pretty interesting to have you on the show right here, right after it's going out and still a hot topic, and curious to get some of your thoughts on it. You want to quickly summarize your perspective?
Well, I think anyone who's read the article already has my perspective in no uncertain terms and is as candid as possible in a nice condensed 500-word format, which I hope everyone understands was the primary purpose. You get a candid perspective on what goes on in my mind when I think about, you know, whether I should consume meats or consume dairy or, you know, participate in those kind of issues with animals. That having been said, in a longer conversation or in, say, a policy discussion at the American Humanist Association, there are lots of other things that might come up or that we might be understanding about. It's not acceptable, certainly, but you got my unfettered and unfiltered view of what I think about these things. And then in daily business, I hope everyone understands that I'm not trying to change policy. A lot of people are like, oh, you know, because you had a strong opinion, you are religious. Because you have a strong opinion, you're saying that the American Humanist Association is now requires as its for membership being vegan. You know, and these things are not the case.
Well, that clearly wasn't the case, given that they also had Fred Edwards writing that it's totally okay to eat meat, and that certainly wasn't being positioned as the new official stance of the American Humanist Association. It was a dialogue, and it was certainly interesting. It's raised a lot of questions. It got me thinking, I have to say. I read through it, and personally, and this is no offense to Fred, who I love, but I thought your article was better reasoned as far as the immorality of eating meat versus his reasoning on why it's okay to eat meat. That said, even though I thought your article was more persuasive, it wasn't persuasive enough to get me to stop eating meat because it's delicious.
That is a good reason to eat meat. It does taste good. That is one priority that may be important to you.
I just want to jump in before we continue to fill listeners in. So Jason Torpy and Fred Edwards both submitted articles to the American Humanist Association's weekly publication called Humanist Network News, which is an e-zine. And if you go to americanhumanist.org/HNN, they're both recent articles. And so you'll find Why Vegan Priorities Are Humanist Priorities, as well, written by Jason Torpy, as well as An Omnivorous Animal Agenda by Fred Edwards. So read both of those, come up with your opinion, come back and listen.
Jess, what's your take?
Well, I eat meat, and I think that I've given myself an excuse to eat meat, which is that I have and Jason, you're going to dismantle this with your eyes shut and one hand tied behind your back, because I know it's a weak argument. I have a gluten intolerance, which means that I can't eat wheat gluten, which is a protein that makes bread good. It's the gooey stuff in bread. And a lot of the sort of synthetic meat that vegetarians eat the protein that they use is gluten. And that stuff is like, it's terrible for me. I can't digest it and I'm allergic to it and all that stuff. So I've kind of justified eating meat by saying, well, I can't really eat all the fake meat. Granted, I could eat vegetables, I could eat beans, I could eat legumes, I could eat fruits and vegetables and other things, and whole grains and some whole grains. And I do still do that. I just also occasionally eat meat. I don't eat it every day, though.
By the way, Jason's sitting next to me. He appears to be salivating, and not over a delicious chunk of broccoli, or I don't know what she would call it, a hunk of cauliflower. But I think he's salivating because he knows he can slam you on that response.
I think that Jess did a wonderful job of saying how wrong it is and how many other options there are that she has available to her. However, I don't have anything to add.
I do choose to purchase my meat from farms when I can, or to buy free range eggs and things like that. But I understand it's still the lesser of evils.
I actually watched one of the videos that Hemant Mehta posted on Friendly Atheist about this, and it showed all sorts of animals being slaughtered, and it was awful. I was not enjoying watching it. I felt terrible for the cows and goats, and it certainly wasn't a pleasant thing to watch. And I struggled with it for a while because I was having trouble coming up with ethical reasons to eat meat. But I think in the end, the reality is I am an omnivore. There's no denying that. It's like, why should I deny myself meat as an omnivore? It would be cruel to deny a tiger meat as a carnivore. Why should I deny myself meat? It seems like a unnecessary restriction. And I no longer do the hunting myself, but I'm okay outsourcing my hunting to these butchers that slaughter these animals. And yeah, that act is horrible, but hey, it's who we are. We're humans. It's part of being human. Is that a divine level of ethics? No, but the reality is there's three people on this call, and two of them believe it's totally okay to eat meat. And I'm all for the morality of democracy. And you've been voted down, Jason. I'm sorry. So you're morally wrong.
Jess, would you like to clarify your vote? Because that's not what I heard.
Yeah.
It's okay to eat meat, and I eat meat are two different responses.
This is true. I actually also recently read another article about it was a student reflecting on growing up, how she grew up out in, I think it was somewhere in the Midwest, and they only ate game that they caught. And she just was reflecting on the judgment that she got from people because they're like, you're a freak and you're eating this like disgusting meat. And she's like, but I respect it. They make use of the total animal. They make use of the hide, of the bones. They eat the meat. They use they make a relish out of the other, like the innards and things like that. And she's like, there's so much more respect to what we're doing and we're earning it. And you just go to the store and you pick up this hunk of flesh, like rotting on top of a piece of styrofoam wrapped in saran wrap. And who's less civilized, us or you? And it kind of like a light bulb went off for me. I was like, huh, like at least like she has a moment where she like connects with whatever it is that she's going to eat, or someone in her family does, which is certainly far less removed than we are from our food. While I wouldn't recommend going out and slaughtering chicken to anyone, or going to Africa and trying to catch your game to eat, I think that there's something to that.
I'm switching sides. You lost me completely when you started talking about relish made from innards. I don't think I can eat meat again, at least for a few more days. Can I give up meat for the rest of Lent?
So we're 3-0 on whether it's right or wrong.
Jason's like, I haven't said a word yet. I win. All you have to do is have the truth on your side.
Yeah, he's very persuasive, isn't he?
Jason, have you ever eaten meat? Is this have you been a vegan all your life?
Yeah, I have eaten meat. Is the answer to your question? I switched. I left West Point in 2000. I graduated. I guess I didn't just wander off. But I graduated in 2000. I actually had a CFI, Center for Inquiry, summer session. They think they still do it for students. Way back in 2000, I went to their summer session for a week, and there were vegans there, and it seemed like the thing to do. And I had been thinking about it and wrestling with it a little bit already, and provided a little bit of positive examples. And, you know, the listeners might consider local vegetarian or vegan groups, and they'll show up and get lots of pontification and very pompous and unflinching vegan opinions, I'm sure. But at the same time, you should get a lot of good ideas about, you know, what to eat and how to eat, and just seeing a little bit of example, you know, on that short week there, you know, from the subset of vegans that happened to be there, you know, I switched. And over the years, over the several years between then and now, there have been certain instances where I ate meat or dairy products. Even now, I'm not perfect. Uh-oh. Everybody decided it's okay now. You know, I'm totally, you know, my argument is set aside because I'm not perfect.
So you're admitting
hopefully
sin.
Not. Yeah. Sinning is a very, very relevant topic for us. If you define sin as things that you do that you think are wrong, You know, I mean, there may be other things that, that we ought not to do, but if I know it's wrong and I do it anyway, that's the best definition I know of sin. So occasionally I have sinned in the last 10 years.
Jason, is there a spectrum, a degree of sin as far as the things that, like the types of animal byproducts or products that you eat?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's the question, for example, you might consider, well, I ate broccoli and broccoli was alive and now it's not. Or I ate a mollusk and that's basically just a muscle that opens up and, well, a muscle specifically just opens and closes. So maybe it can't really appreciate suffering in the same way that a cow does or a pig does or a dolphin does or your house pet or your sister. I mean, so in that case, let's be realistic. There is a spectrum. And where you put the line is really the question. Do you put the line above broccoli or do you put the line above, you know, right below the house pet?
Right.
So that's another question. And then, you know, there's degree in how things are handled. Like foie gras, for example, can be very torturous to a duck. If we say a more accessible example for veal is well understood to be
delicious.
Young calves that, you know, can't move and they're basically kept in torturous conditions for a period of their life and then they're sent to slaughter. And that's different than Farmer Bob that goes out and milks the cow, you know, every day. And then, you know, with the, you know, later on in life, you know, there's a quick death and a clean kill. You know, maybe that's not okay also, but when you look at your options, do you put the line below factory farming or do you put the line somewhere below Farmer Bob and you know, a clean and organic and truly open range farm?
I'm sitting here thinking about how many of us on this Skype, this conference call right now, this podcast, if you will, and how many of our listeners are going to have a reaction formation, psychological defense to this, and not want to think about it and go out and just pig out on meat to help prove to themselves, I'm a real carnivore. Because I might have to have a big juicy hamburger tonight just to try to wash away the sin. Well, Jason, thank you for stopping by my office randomly, but not so randomly, to share a few moments with us.
Yes, and thank you, everyone, for having me on here and for reading my article and for not coming by my house with torches. And this is excellent. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
I never looked around, never second guessed. Then I read somehow it's in. Now I'm always depressed. And now I can't sleep from years of apathy. All because I read a little Noam Chomsky. I'm eating vegetation as a fast food. I wear a couple shoes cause of globalization. I'm watching Michael Moore expose the awful truth. I'm listening to Public Enemy and Reagan Youth. I see no world peace.
Well, up next, Todd, we're going to be talking to one of my coworkers who, you know, I work up in upstate New York, and so I don't actually get to see my coworkers very often. So we're going to call Maggie Ardiente, who is our Director of Development and Communications for the American Humanist Association. And Maggie is going to be telling us about the upcoming conference that we've been talking about.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Maggie is an awesome person. She's actually also one of the speakers at the conference this year.
Okay, listeners, we're here with Maggie Ardiente, who is a Director of Development and Communications for the American Humanist Association, i.e. my coworker. How you doing, Maggie?
Good. How are you, Jess?
I'm doing excellent. So I thought we would have just a quick discussion about the conference that we have coming up.
Well, the conference will be held in Boston, actually Cambridge, Massachusetts, at the Hyatt Regency Cambridge. It'll be held April 7th through the 10th. And we're very excited. We have a great lineup of speakers this year. This year's Humanist of the Year will be Rebecca Goldstein. She's a professor at Harvard and the author of 36 Arguments for the Existence of God. She's also known for being the wife of Steven Pinker, who will also be there. And he's a former Humanist of the Year. He won the award back in 2006 at our conference in Tampa. So we're excited to have them both attending. We'll also have Richard Dawkins speaking. He's also won the Humanist of the Year. And so we have a lot of great former Humanists of the Year coming to this particular conference. Other awardees that I'm excited about is Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple Computers. And people like Bart Ehrman, who's a religious scholar, Judy Norsigian, who's a feminist activist. One of our keynote speakers is Jeff Charlotte, who wrote C Street and the Family about American fundamentalism. So we're very excited about a lot of these great speakers, big names, and people who have been really involved in the movement for a long time.
There's also going to be some fun with music there. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. We're going to have Roy Zimmerman there.
Awesome.
Roy Zimmerman is pretty well known with the atheist and humanist movement. Does a lot of great songs on creation science, making fun of Bill O'Reilly. So we're really excited to have him. We've had him at our previous conferences before. We just love having him again. I hope maybe we'll even have him again next year. He's just so fun, comes up with such unique songs, and he really just works the crowd. We're really excited to have him this year.
That's awesome. And there's another person that I can't wait to meet and hopefully interview. And she's sort of one of the newest additions to our honorees, and that's Candace Gingrich Jones.
Oh, that's right. Right. Yeah, we just added her on, so we're very excited about that. She's receiving the first LGBT Humanist Pride Award. LGBT issues has been of incredible importance to humanists and the AHA for many years. And Candace Gingrich Jones has really been at the forefront of the LGBT movement. With her activism in HRC, Human Rights Campaign, she's, you know, very vocal, you know, speaking out against her half-brother, Newt Gingrich, who is very famous for being pretty anti-LGBT rights. So we're so excited that she's joined the lineup. And hopefully I think this means that we'll get further involved in the LGBT movement and have more LGBT humanists also joining the cause.
Now, just so our listeners know, the way that these conferences work is that all the awardees that we just mentioned are given their award either at one of our luncheons or at one of the banquets in the evening. But there's all sorts of stuff happening throughout the weekend during the day, right? We have breakout sessions and panel discussions and things like that. Is there anything from the schedule that you want to highlight for listeners?
Well, we're very excited about the Secular Student Alliance, which is holding their leadership summit in conjunction with our conference. So they're going to have an entire track of training sessions geared toward students, toward chapter leaders, toward anyone who's interested in what the student movement is doing. And they'll be doing that all day Saturday, April 9th. So definitely check out a lot of their sessions and check out their schedule. It's on the AHA's website and also at secularstudents.org. Also on Friday, there'll be a full day of all kinds of sessions. Now, our sessions vary in topics. You know, they range from human rights, international rights, feminism, general humanism. One particular session that I'm interested in is does humanist meditation exist? Which will happen on Friday at 1:30. We're very excited about sort of seeing how that ties in together. Lots of other things like humanism and healthcare. I'm talking about humanist chaplaincies and how we can get more of those on universities and in hospitals and things like that. Manuel Manga is an evolutionary leader scholar, and he'll be talking a little bit about evolutionary leadership and how that can apply to humanism. We also have people from the International Humanist and Ethical Union that will be talking about humanism on the global level. So we have a lot. It's just really varied, lots of different types of sessions. Basically, you have your choice during a certain 1.5-hour block. Sometimes we find that in the past people say, oh, there's so many good sessions here, I don't know which one to pick. So, you know, we actually like that. That's a really good compliment that tells us that people really like the sessions that we're holding. And hopefully we'll just see more of that in future years.
Absolutely. It sounds like there's something for everyone here. That's great.
I'm really looking forward to seeing Cecil Bothwell there as well. I had the fortunate to see him speak at a meeting here in Raleigh. He's the Asheville City Council member who's an open atheist and actually was challenged into his office with some people that tried to have him removed from office because the North Carolina Constitution says that you have to have a belief in God to hold public office. And that challenge fortunately didn't go very far, but it got a lot of publicity and caused a lot of frustration. So he's another one of the great speakers we'll have.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have him. He's somebody that we wanted to have last year, actually, when we were in San Jose. But the timing didn't work out, and it was great because he lives on, you know, he lives in Asheville, North Carolina, on the East Coast. So we're really glad that he was able to come to the conference in Cambridge. And personally, I just think it's great when we have, you know, elected leaders sharing their stories about how they're an out atheist, and how sometimes it's interesting. You think there's going to be a lot of backlash, and sometimes there is, but in general, a lot of people feel really good. They're very happy that somebody is an atheist and is elected. And it sometimes ends up being a good thing overall for everybody there. So I'm excited to hear his story as well.
Well, I know for me, these conferences are a time to put a face to all those names that we always hear about and the people that we're working with. And so much of what we do as humanists is we have coalitions and we talk about the philosophy of whether or not God exists. And this is a time to put all the philosophy in motion, but it's with people. You also get to connect with people and you get to be re-inspired to the work that we all think is so important.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, there's one interesting thing is that the Harvard Humanist Chaplaincy is holding a volunteer event that's going to take place on Sunday after the conference. Now, the details haven't been quite worked yet, but there's a plan to do that, and we're really excited about sort of seeing how, you know, you have a few days of philosophy and talking and sort of general, you know, discussion over the philosophy. And then there's a component where if our people are motivated to volunteer and help their community, we'll have that available for those people after the conference. So we're going to combine both of these things. And we're hoping that this is a tradition that will continue in future conferences as well.
Oh, that's cool. Now I have a decision to make because I was planning on going to Salem for the tour that's going to be happening after the conference on Sunday afternoon as well. So it's a toss up. Do I do community service or do I go burn witches? I'm not sure.
I know it is really tough. I know sometimes we have conflicting events that happen and people can't decide. Also, of course, the Skeptics Tour of Salem is really exciting. We have, that's almost filled, which I'm amazed about. It's great. We are going to have a full bus nearly. They're going to go to Salem. They're going to see all the old witch houses and learn more about that. And this is led by a skeptic, Jeff Wagg, who lives in the Boston area. So it's going to be a really unique tour. You'll have your fellow humanists unwinding after the conference. It'll just be a fun event, and I hope everyone enjoys it.
So have we picked a location and theme for next year's conference?
We have picked a location. It'll be in New Orleans in
Sweet.
2012. And it'll be in June. It'll be, I think it's the first weekend in June, June 7th to the 10th, I want to say. And we'll actually have information about the conference in just a couple of weeks, almost a week during our conference in Boston. We'll have special save the date cards for people so that they can put it on their calendars right away. So it'll be June 7th to the 10th, 2012, in New Orleans at the Sheraton. Of course, we're really excited about that. A lot of people, you know, New Orleans is a great place. We haven't been in the middle of the country in a really long time. We usually hold our conferences on the East or the West. And thinking about community service, we'll definitely be doing some kind of community service in response to, you know, Katrina and then some of the work that, you know, New Orleans is still doing to rebuild the city. So we're very excited about getting involved, very excited about working with the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association, which is a great group. So, I know it's over a year away, but we're pretty excited about that too.
Sounds good to me. So listeners, mark your calendars. We want to see you this year, but we also want to see you next year.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Maggie, and thanks in advance for all the hard work I know you and the team are doing to make this a great conference for all the attendees. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a blast.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, we're all very excited to go, and we'll see you all in Cambridge.
Sounds good. Thanks, Maggie.
Thanks, Maggie.
All right, thank you.
Well, listeners, that was Maggie Ardiente talking about the exciting upcoming AHA conference, and you can learn more and sign up to go and see us there at AmericanHumanist.org/conference.
Moving right along, Todd. It's time to talk about our sort of featured guest, which is Fred Edwards. So if you find yourself saying, gosh, that name sounds familiar, it's probably because Fred has a very long history with organized humanism.
Indeed. He's been active for well over 30 years in the movement. And was actually the executive director for the American Humanist Association for 15 years and the editor of the Humanist Magazine for 12.
He has also been president of Camp Quest, which is the summer camp beyond belief for children. And he's served on the board for the International Humanist and Ethical Union, which is the IHEU.
Yeah, and now he is the national director for the United Coalition of Reason, which has been around since 2009 and is doing a great job fostering communities around the country. And we'll be learning a lot more about that directly from him.
So Todd and I spoke with Fred via Skype earlier in the month.
Welcome, Fred. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Great, Fred. So you are the national director of the United Coalition of Reason. Can you just tell our listeners what exactly that is?
Yes. The national director directs the United Coalition of Reason. That's what it is. But actually, the United Coalition of Reason is a loose association of coalitions. That is, the United Coalition of Reason goes around the country and gets the various groups in the larger community of reason working together. Now, community of reason is a euphemism for all of those atheist, agnostic, free thought, bright, humanist, secularist, skeptic, postifarian, and whatever other names groups go by in our larger community of reason. Our goal is to get these groups working together to raise their public profile jointly. So what we do is we get them formed into a local coalition, and then we sponsor a coalition website that lists all of the groups with links to the websites of each of the groups and a description of each group, to thus create a kind of one-stop shopping in a given area for people looking for the free thought, humanist, secularist, atheist, agnostic, whatever type of group they want. And then we run an advertising media campaign designed to bring public attention to the coalition, bring web traffic to the coalition website, and thus get more people finding out that there are all of these humanists, secularists, atheists, and so forth in their community.
So you folks come in and free of charge to these local organizations, provide them with a website to help link them together and a marketing campaign. That almost sounds too good to be true.
We just do it like a foundation would. We provide the benefits, but they don't have to fill out any paperwork. They don't have to apply for a grant and then show that they are worthy and stable enough to receive the grant, because we're just buying the stuff for them. So that stuff is not an issue. So all we want in return is a little recognition, a banner on their website, or if they use the website we provide them, it's already got that built in, and that gives us all the recognition we want.
Fred, you mentioned that one of the services that you guys provide for the local coalitions is that you try to give them media attention. Can you highlight some of the achievements that you guys have had in the past?
Sure. We get lots of media attention with what we do, because the key isn't just that we fund or that we buy them a billboard or a series of billboards or a campaign on the sides of their buses or in their subway stations or whatever. It isn't just that. What we do is we issue press releases that get media attention and bring the media to them, and the media covers them in a big way, and that creates a lot of buzz, which then flows out onto the internet. And so it goes well beyond the billboard that we put up or the bus ads to all of that media attention. The people hear about it, and it brings more traffic to the local websites. So the kind of things we've had happen is that, like in the Fort Worth, Texas area, a bus ad went up, and the bus company had to run the ad because they run religious ads. So they had to run ours, otherwise they would be engaged in content discrimination. But when they ran our ad, a number of local ministers got all upset. They had a short-term bus boycott over it. Some other religious people arranged to have one of those billboard trucks follow one of the buses around with a religious ad to counter our ad. And then other people put up counter billboards and counter bus ads and things like that. And there was just a lot of discussion and talk. And that's good. That's good for us because that creates a lot of buzz, a lot of publicity, a lot of talk, and it generates lots of new members for the groups involved.
Do you have any valuable best practices or lessons learned that you might be able to share with the listeners from some of your stronger or longest lasting coalitions?
So the way that the coalitions keep going and functioning is by holding coalition events from time to time, and also by the leaders getting together, comparing notes and talking shop. That's one of the things that we wanted to encourage when we first started this, was to get the leaders talking to each other and learning from each other so that everybody isn't reinventing the wheel. Everybody wins that way. Sometimes, too, they can come up with new campaigns. One thing we found in the case of the Philadelphia Coalition of Reason, PhillyCor, was after they put their billboard up and they got some complaints by a local church about it, they got together with that church and did a joint charitable project at the local food bank to help the homeless. And because PhillyCor was a coalition of all of the groups in the area, including ethical culture and atheist and humanist and freethought groups, they were able to bring as many people into the effort as that local church was able to bring in. They brought in equal numbers and they worked together, and it created another news story that here were these people who at first the coalition seemed to be the local bad boys running their billboard, although the billboards really aren't controversial, but people take them that way. And so then they turn around and do this charitable activity jointly with a church, and all of a sudden they're nice guys. So, again, that made for another news story, and it didn't cost anything. They didn't have to spend any money for a billboard or anything like that. So we encourage coalitions to come up with new projects that can get them publicity that don't require the outlay of thousands of dollars for a billboard or bus ad campaign.
Let's say there are listeners out there now who are part of a smaller organization that might be able to join with other organizations to create a local United Core in their area. What can they do? Who do they contact? How do they get involved?
All they have to do is email info@unitedcore.org. So that's just info@unitedcore.org. And that's it. Just send me an email and say that you're interested in forming a coalition. Talk to the other groups in the area to determine that interest, and then be able to tell me what the names of the groups are that might be interested. And I'll take it from there, working with whoever contacts me. The other thing I do when I'm in the area is I put on a media training seminar. This lasts about 3 hours. It's free, and it's for anyone who wants to attend who is interested in learning how to more effectively work the media for promoting our kinds of ideas. And so I teach in a very intensive way how to go about doing this. I have lots of handouts and lots of information I provide, and teach people basically how to be effective in radio and television interviews, how to talk to reporters from the print media, how to write press releases, how to conduct publicity stunts, and how to conduct yourself when dealing with radio and TV and newspaper reporters.
I've heard you talk a great deal about getting media attention. Is the primary goal of the United Coalition of Reason to generate more media attention in these local markets?
Yes. The idea is to raise the public profile of our kinds of ideas. Because you see, right now, a lot of people think that they're the only ones. They're out there, a lonely atheist, agnostic, or free thinker, or maybe they're not lonely, but they just think they're the only one who thinks like them, or they only know a few people who do. It's surprising how many people go to traditional religious churches just because that's what their family does, or it's the only show in town that they know of. But they don't realize that maybe there's an ethical culture society, a very liberal Unitarian Universalist church, an atheist group, or what have you in their area. Maybe the humanists are very active, but they just haven't heard about it because a lot of these groups just don't have the money to publicize their existence. So this is a way of publicizing everybody at once and creating a rising tide that lifts all the boats. And that's what we do, and we work locally. Because that's our goal, is to raise the public profile, because so many more people would join groups like ours if they only knew we existed. We're not trying to convert anybody. I mean, we don't mind if it happens, but that's not the goal. We're not trying to go door to door and sell atheism. That just wouldn't work very effectively. So we're not going to bother trying to convert the unconverted. There are too many people who already agree with us for us to get organized, that'll take up all of our time.
Fred, I've heard you mention bus ads in billboards. Can you talk a little bit more about what are the messages that are going on these ads in billboards, and how does that process work?
Okay, first of all, we have picked rather benign slogans. Since our aim is merely to attract like-minded people to the groups in question, we aren't trying to attack anyone's religion. We aren't trying to convert anyone. All of that's a waste of time. We're just trying to say to those who already think like us, hey, we're over here. And since that's the goal, that's what the wording of all of our ads reflects. So the main slogan we use is, don't believe in God? You are not alone. And it's against a blue sky and fluffy white cloud background, because you know how nature scenes and the sky in particular have been traditionally associated with religion. And we say, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe we should take back the sky here. And some people actually find that controversial, that we would dare to use the blue sky and clouds. But in any case, that's our message. Just don't believe in God, you are not alone. And yet so many people take that as an attack on their religion. And at first, I couldn't figure out why, because all we were doing was making a shout out to our own audience. But it turns out that when you use the word God, a lot of people think you're talking about their guy. You're not just talking about a supreme being. You're not just talking about some generic theological concept, which is the way we atheists, agnostics, and such tend to look at it. When we use the word God, we tend to mean it in that philosophic sense. But traditional religious people think it means their guy. And I've actually had someone say, how dare you attack Roman Catholicism with your ad? I actually got a phone call on that. Well, I talked to the guy at some length, and I actually got him to see that we weren't attacking his religion at all, leastwise no more than we were making it clear that we didn't believe in anybody's religion, and his included, but that we weren't attacking anybody. Another one of our slogans says, are you good without God? Millions are. And again, it's the same kind of idea. It's asking, are you one of those folks like us who can have moral values without a theological concept? Then, hey, we're over here. So it's the same kind of thing. You don't have to poke a stick in their eye, it turns out, to get their attention. All you have to do is dare to say, we're atheists and agnostics, and we exist, and we exist in your community, and we're prepared to talk openly about it and recruit our own in public. Just the very idea of that is just too shocking to some people who are so used to having hegemony for their views, having a free pass all of these years and never having to deal with us. So right now, being somebody like us, just being us, just existing and talking about it, is controversial. So that puts us in that sweet spot right now where we're not so controversial that we're beyond the pale, don't exist, or no one dares talk about us. And we're not so accepted that we're no longer interesting. We're at that sweet spot where once we make ourselves known, people can't stop talking about us.
Have any of your coalitions ever had a booth at a state fair?
We've in fact found that if we run our billboard campaigns in connection with the timing and placement of state fairs, whether we have a booth at the state fair or not, that is often a very effective way of getting attention. So in Oklahoma City, when we had our billboard campaign there, we put the billboard up right near the state fairgrounds and had it there during the time of the state fair. We launched it ahead of the state fair and had it continue through the run of the state fair so that we could in effect be saying to the people in Oklahoma City, hey, look, we're going to let all visitors to your city know that you've got atheists and agnostics in your town. A lot of people find that shocking. They really don't want that known. Well, we do want that known. And if that makes us controversial, all the better. It gets our point across that much more. And so now our new effort this year in 2011 is that we're putting additional money into the effort, going beyond the billboard and bus ad campaigns, to actually fund state fair, county fair, city fair, and other such exhibits. And so we will support local groups that want to have, whether they've already had one of our billboard campaigns or not, will support up to the cost of $1,000 state fair exhibits. Let me add something that they are toying with at a couple of these fairs that different groups have been playing with. And that is, they're thinking they want to have a dunk an atheist tank. that they want to sit a person there, and then you throw balls. You pay a certain amount of money to throw balls at the target, that then if you hit the target, then the atheist gets dunked in the drink. Or maybe it would even be baptized an atheist. I don't know. but the point is, that would create a lot of excitement, a lot of fun. Obviously, we don't take it seriously. They're a lot more likely to take it seriously than we do, or not. Some people will do it for a lark. Some people will do it because they think we deserve it. But it would generate attention, and it would make money for the group.
That's awesome.
That is great. Now, Fred, you've got this idea of sort of coupling launching United Cores with state happenings or local happenings. Can you tell us what else is on the horizon for United Core?
In Orlando, Florida, there is that an amusement park called the Holy Land Experience. Well, the Holy Land Experience becomes a big deal around Easter time, as you might imagine. So Orlando wants to launch their billboard campaign just ahead of Easter. Not targeting directly the Holy Land Experience, because you don't want to do that. If you put your billboards up right next to a place like the Holy Land Experience, you're going to give them publicity. We're not interested in that. We don't want to react to them. We want them to react to us. So we're not tying it to them. But we know that there's a lot going on then around Easter time. And so that's when we'll have our billboards up. And let's see if they get all excited about it. Because after all, it's at those times, during the holiday times, when people like us recognize most acutely that we aren't in the mainstream of society as far as our numbers are concerned. Actually, our ideas are quite mainstream in the realm of science and in the arts and many other areas. But nonetheless, culturally, we are not seen as mainstream. And so atheists and agnostics feel particularly isolated at these times of year, or become acutely aware that they're not in the majority of the general population. So what better time than then for us to be reaching out to our audience? That's when our audience of atheists and agnostics is most interested in what we have to say.
Well, Fred, I just want to say thank you for doing the work that you're doing at United Core. It sounds just like a really smart, strategic way of connecting the free thought and atheist groups, and also providing opportunities for the free thought groups to work with religious organizations. I think that on both folds, it sounds like there's a lot of potential for growth, and I think it's great.
Yeah, there is. And in fact, one of the things I'm finding both nationally and locally is a lot more cooperation in the humanist, free thought, atheist movement. And so the community of reason is thriving in not only its numbers rising, but in terms of its mutual cooperation, its internal cooperation. It's just a wonderful thing to see. I've been in this movement going back since the late 1970s, and I've never seen the high level of cooperation and working together that I'm seeing today, and it's just gratifying.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much, Fred.
You're welcome.
That was Fred Edwards, National Director of the United Coalition of Reason. Learn more at unitedcore.org. That's United Core, UNITEDCOR.org.
Well, listeners, I have to say I really enjoyed this month's episode. Got to laugh a lot and have a lot of fun. I'm also really excited about next month, where we will be spending a lot of time with the guests and speakers from the 70th anniversary conference of the AHA, which will be held in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the Hyatt Regency Cambridge.
Listeners, you can register for the conference at AmericanHumanist.org/conference. You can learn more about those speakers that Maggie mentioned. Look forward to seeing some of you listeners. I remember meeting some of you last year, so I hope that we continue that this year.
And I look forward to meeting you, Jess.
I look forward to meeting you as well. And I think it's going to be fun. I think that, you know, as much fun as I'm having right now talking over, you know, through cyberspace with you, just imagine the damage we can do in person.
Absolutely. To the bar.
To the bar. Great. Well, listeners, we would love to hear what you think. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you want to hear. Let us know your thoughts on the Brigham Young controversy with the honor code. And let us know about what your eating habits are or your thoughts on vegan versus omnivore. And isn't this a humanist issue in your opinion? And also, I would love for you guys to let us know how you think Todd's doing as my new co-host. I think he's rocking it. So, Todd, tell listeners how they can get in touch with us.
Yeah, you can get in touch with us at our listener comment line at 202-618-1371. Be great to hear from you.
You can also send us an email at podcast@thehumanisthour.org. And in those weeks where you're waiting with bated breath for our next podcast episode, you can still keep in touch with what's happening in the humanist movement by reading the Humanist Network News e-zine at AmericanHumanist.org/HNN.
You can also go to HumanistPodcast.org to listen to previous episodes and to see show notes.
So listeners, stay tuned, keep in touch, and be well. Happy spring.
Happy spring, folks.
Thanks for listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Todd Stiefel.